when it came to Supreme Court justices.
And what about how the Supreme Court compares to other courts, federal appeals courts, courts, state courts?
Yeah, you know, lower federal court judges do have more binding rules than the Supreme Court. You know, what we've been focused on is there is this law that was passed after Watergate in the 70s that requires justices to make annual financial disclosures, including of most gifts above a few hundred dollars. As you mentioned a few minutes ago, Justice Thomas last week had to amend his 2019 filings to disclose free trips he got from Harlan Crow to Indonesia.
And these are private jets.
Private jets. Harlan Crow also has a super yacht where, you know, the staff of 20 workers, where Justice Thomas has, on that trip in 2019, they hopped around islands in Indonesia and has been on that around the whole world, really. He also had to disclose another trip, also via private jet, to the Bohemian Grove, which is this sort of secretive all men's retreat in Northern California. And, you know, that was actually the third time in the last 10 or 15 years that Justice Thomas has had to amend his legally required financial disclosure forms. The third time he said some version of I misunderstood the rules or I inadvertently missed these things.
And is this all in response to ProPublica's reporting?
The latest two times were, 10 or 15 years ago, he had to disclose Ginni Thomas's income in response to some other reporting.
His wife.
Yeah.
And that was significant because...
These annual financial disclosures are required by law, so he has been violating the law repeatedly. And I have always thought it's striking that you have a Supreme Court justice whose job is to interpret the law. You know, Justice Thomas obviously famously is an originalist and a textualist, supposed to be all about close reading of the text, and he's just repeatedly acknowledged that he has misunderstood this law and had to amend his forms only after media reports about things that he should have included legally.
What about this issue of recusal? The call for these justices to recuse themselves, explain why, especially for Clarence Thomas, around anything to do with Trump and the insurrection, and around Alito as well. And also, let's remember that these judges who are in the justices who are in the crossfire now, Alito and Clarence Thomas, neither of them were chosen by Trump, right? Trump appointed another three.
Yeah, you know, the recusal rules are interesting, and it's actually pretty simple, which is the justices themselves, actually each individual justice, has absolute power to decide whether he or she recuses from a case. So there's no—it's not Chief Justice Roberts or some panel or Congress or anything like that. They have absolute power to decide. You know, maybe even more strikingly, they don't have to explain their decisions. So sometimes a justice will, actually most of the time when a justice does recuse himself or herself, you just get a little notation saying they didn't hear this case and you can kind of speculate as to why. I think this was most relevant in our reporting, actually, when it came to Justice Alito. One of the stories we did was about hedge fund billionaire, Paul Singer, a major Republican donor. He runs a hedge fund called Elliott Management, no relation to me, Paul Singer partly paid for a luxury Alaska fishing vacation that Justice Alito went on. We published as Justice Alito standing next to Paul Singer holding these giant Alaska king salmon they'd caught. It turned out Paul Singer's hedge fund in this same period, both before and after the trip, had a series of cases at the court. This was part of this very long-running fight between Paul Singer's hedge fund and the nation of Argentina over bonds that the hedge fund was trying to collect on, pursuing in court. No one knew about this trip at the time because we hadn't reported until, you know, many years later, last year. And Justice Alito did not recuse himself from this case, from the case that the Supreme Court ultimately did rule on, ruled in favor of Paul Singer's hedge fund. That was entirely up to him. He later argued that he didn't have to recuse himself. He actually also argued that he didn't even know that Paul Singer was connected to this hedge fund. But I believe, actually, under the bill that Senate Democrats were pushing yesterday, in that sort of situation, when you received a gift from somebody who was connected to a case, you would be required to recuse yourself. So if that ever became law, that would be a huge change.
And finally, Justin, what is, in addition, of course, to the case that you just mentioned, where there are financial incentives, for the donor. What is the ideological orientation of these billionaires?
You know, when it came to the billionaires we were writing about who were giving things to Justices Thomas and Alito, almost entirely across the board, we're talking about not just wealthy businessmen, but people who were very politically active on the right. I mean, Paul Singer, for example, for many years has been one of the biggest donors to Republican and conservative causes. Same with Harlan Crowe, the Dallas real estate billionaire, who also specifically gives money to conservative legal causes. I believe there's one exception to this, the man that gave Justice Thomas his multi-hundred-thousand-dollar RV, was more in the middle of the road, but they were friends going back to their 20s, so that was a bit of a different situation. But generally, the pattern was very clear that we were talking about, Republican donor billionaires.
And does the Senate Judiciary Committee have power over demanding that they recuse, or Chief Justice Roberts?
Neither the Judiciary Committee nor Chief Justice Roberts has that power, but I will say the Senate Judiciary Committee does have a lot of power to investigate what's going on. There's really no reason to believe that we actually know all the facts about what these justices have gotten. The stories that we did took, months and months of reporting from my colleagues and I, and, the Senate Judiciary Committee has something that we don't have, which is subpoena power. And they actually have been investigating. It's been moving very slowly, sort of unclear why they haven't gotten more at this point. They authorized subpoenas for Leonard Leo and Harlan Crowe to get more information. I believe they actually still haven't issued the subpoena to Harlan Crowe. Unclear why. But we're very curious to see how that all plays out.
And this is Dick Durbin, chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Right.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Justin Elliott, for joining us, reporter for ProPublica, co-wrote the new report headlined Justice Clarence Thomas acknowledges he should have disclosed free trips from billionaire donor. ProPublica just received its seventh Pulitzer Prize for its Supreme Court coverage. And thanks again to Lauren Windsor, the documentarian, for letting us use these recordings. I want to thank you both so much. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, the World Conflict Report. And then we speak with a Palestinian ambassador. Stay with us. Sugar Pie Honey Bunch by Motown legends The Four Tops. One of the group's members, Alexander Morris, is suing the Detroit area Ascension Hospital to, quote, protect the younger generations from racism in health care after he sought help for chest pain and trouble breathing after a history of heart problems. When the famous singer expressed security concerns about possible stalkers, he said the staff failed to check his ID and instead put him in a straitjacket and ordered a psychological evaluation, quote, despite his clear symptoms of cardiac distress. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
The United Nations Refugee Agency announced earlier today that a record 120 million people are now displaced around the world. Filippo Grandi, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, spoke in Geneva.
The last figure that we have been sharing with you, if you recall, was 114 million. So we estimate that the most updated figure is now 120 million. So it has gone up by another 6 million. These are refugees, asylum seekers, internally displaced people, people being forced by conflict, by persecution, by different and increasingly complex forms of violence. the way conflicts are conducted by the parties, almost everywhere, by almost all parties, in complete disregard of the laws of war, of international humanitarian law, and often with the specific purpose of terrorizing people, of making people instill fear in people. This, of course, is a powerful contributor to more displacement than even in the past.
This comes as a new report from the Peace Research Institute Oslo has found there were more armed conflicts last year than in any year since World War II, as fighting rages in Gaza, Ukraine, Sudan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Ethiopia, and other areas. We're joined right now by Siri Rastad, Research Director at the Peace Research Institute Oslo. Siri, I hope by saying your name I'm not activating everyone's Siri, but if you could start off by just summarizing the main findings of your report.
The report is based on data from the Uppsala Conflict Data Program at University of Uppsala, and which collects conflict data every year. And this year we see that the number of conflict has reached a record high with 59 conflicts all over the world. The way that these conflicts are defined is that they are what we call state-based conflicts, which include where the state is a part of the conflict. Meaning either conflicts between states like Russia, Ukraine, or civil wars. What we also see this year is there's a decrease in people being killed in conflict. But this says more about the number of people being killed last year rather than this year because of the conflict in Ethiopia last year, as well as Ukraine. So we actually see that in the three past years are the three most violent years since the Cold War.
And so could you talk about, Siri, some of the, the least reported but the deadliest? You mentioned Ethiopia, but also the DRC and Sudan, which are not really reported on nearly as much as either Ukraine or Gaza.
No, absolutely. And this is partly why we published this report, is to put focus on these conflicts as well. So Ethiopia was a conflict that went on mainly in 2021 and 22 in the Tigray region. And I think it took a lot of people by surprise last year when we realized the number of people being killed, partly because of a lack of attention, because of the conflict in Ukraine taking most of the attention, but also the lack of access to the Tigray region by journalists, but also an internet blockout. So there is very little sources to understand what's actually going on. But what we see is that over 2021 and 22, the number of people killed in Ethiopia surpasses the number of people killed in Afghanistan since the end of the Cold War, and is at the height of the number of people being killed in Syria. So it is one of the most bloodiest and deadliest conflicts we have seen in the past 30 years, and the attention is extremely low.
And so could you explain, Siri, in places like that, the organization that you rely on in this report is the Uppsala Conflict Data Program, UCDP, which collects data on conflicts worldwide. How do they get access to this information in places like Ethiopia or the DRC, where access to areas is difficult, and also where there are multiple conflicting parties, especially in the DRC? How do they get,
yes,
for example, the number of casualties, fatalities, etc.?
Yeah. So the way they code this data is that they code conflict events. So when something happens, they code it and they try to establish who are the conflicting parties, where was it, and how many people were killed. Of course, in some areas like Ukraine, you have a lot of sources reporting on this, news sources, etc. While in, for example, Ethiopia, there is hardly anything. So last year, in 2022, they were able to find one report by Amnesty who reported 100,000 killed. But that was the only report they could find. This year, they have been able to supplement the death tolls for 2022 with other reports from the military. But to get access, they use news reports, they use NGO reports, they use social media occasionally. But they also try to make sure that these events are reported by several sources so that they can get the best estimate possible. Of course, this probably means that the numbers that they use are conservative, but they will still give us an idea of the trends that we see.
Siri Rustad, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Research Director at the Peace Research Institute, Oslo, author of the new report, Conflict Trends, A Global Overview, 1946 to 2023. We'll link to it at democracynow.org. Coming up, we speak to the Deputy Permanent Observer of the State of Palestine to the United Nations. Stay with us. By the Selector, the group's vocalist, Gaps Hendrickson, died this week at the age of 73. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to Gaza. The World Health Organization has revealed 8,000 Palestinian children under the age of five have been diagnosed with acute malnutrition. This comes as a major new UN report accuses Israel of committing war crimes and crimes against humanity. This is Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, the head of the WHO.
A significant proportion of Gaza's population is now facing catastrophic hunger and famine-like conditions. Despite reports of increased delivery of food, there is currently no evidence that those who need it most are receiving sufficient quantity and quality of food.
The dire warning from the World Health Organization comes as Israel and Hamas are both facing calls to support the ceasefire and hostage deal that was endorsed by the UN Security Council. On Wednesday, Secretary of State Antony Blinken accused Hamas of being the obstacle to the deal.
Hamas has proposed numerous changes to the proposal that was on the table. We discussed those changes last night with Egyptian colleagues and today with the Prime Minister. Some of the changes are workable, some are not.
We're joined right now by Ambassador Majid Bamia. He is the Deputy Permanent Observer of the State of Palestine to the United Nations. We thank you so much for being with us. Let's start off with this major issue, and that is that Tony Blinken has gone from country to country saying that Hamas is the main obstacle, that they agreed to this proposal weeks ago. Now they're putting in obstacles to the agreement. And he says that Israel has agreed, though we have not heard Prime Minister Netanyahu or other Israeli public officials saying they've agreed to this. What has Hamas agreed to?
So what we've seen is that Hamas welcomed the UN Security Council resolution that was adopted a few days ago, endorsing the plan and spelling out the most important elements of it. I have not seen such a welcoming from the Israeli side. The most important element to our understanding is to secure that all three phases of the plan is implemented, including phase two, which foresees a permanent end of hostilities and a full Israeli withdrawal from the Gaza Strip. And that is going to be negotiated by the parties during phase one. And that's the fear that given the aggressive statements by Israeli leaders that the war will continue, this is not in line with the proposal that we will move from phase one to phase two and not return to the assault that we're seeing with this heavy toll for civilians, as you've been explaining.
Well, Ambassador Bamia, yes, it does appear as though there's been no official statement from Israel that they would accept the present ceasefire proposal, not least because, as some media have reported, Netanyahu's government could fall as a result, since several members of his government have threatened to abandon his administration in the event that he accepts a ceasefire, permanent ceasefire. Meanwhile, the Wall Street Journal earlier this week also reported having seen dozens of messages that the head of Hamas, Sinwar, had written to ceasefire negotiators, other officials in Hamas, that the war was in fact going well, in the sense that Israel's international standing was falling at such a rapid pace that it may well be in Hamas's interest for the war to continue until more stringent measures were taken against Israel in a longer term. If you could respond to that report and your response to these precise messages.
I can have the report on what the Wall Street Journal is saying based on messages it has seen and how accurate this is. We are calling, demanding a ceasefire, an end of this situation. We want to see Palestinians and Israeli families reunited in life for those who are held captive. We want to see an end of the atrocities against our people. We want humanitarian aid to come in and to end this organized famine. This is a inflicted by the decision of the occupying power upon our people. This is inhumane and catastrophic. And all of this is only possible by a ceasefire. All these attempts to find ways to solve these problems without a ceasefire, including the regional escalation, have all failed. And now finally, we are seeing that there's an international consensus, including the United States, conceding that the ceasefire is the only way to achieve all these goals. And let's be clear, Israel, there was a lot of empathy towards Israelis after the 7th of October. It's Israeli government decision to use that empathy to commit a genocide against the Palestinian people instead of trying to find a solution, including ending its occupation, ending the conflict, and ensuring no civilian, Palestinian or Israeli, are harmed, ensuring that no Palestinian or Israeli are held captive, and ensuring that Palestinians are free and Palestine live side by side with Israel, according to UN resolutions.
Well, Ambassador Bamia, if we could also ask for your response to the Israeli operation that led to the release of the four Israeli hostages, but of course also resulted in almost 300 deaths of Palestinians. So there is a report also that the U.S. military was in some sense involved in that operation, either by providing intelligence and possibly more than just intelligence. And in response to that revelation, Hamas has reportedly added another demand to the proposal, the ceasefire proposal, namely that China, Russia and Turkey become guarantors of any deal, along with the countries already agreed upon, the U.S., Egypt, and Qatar.
So on this operation, you know, there were seven hostages who were released in operations. There were over 100 hostages released in a deal. We've had multiple hostages killed in the Israeli bombings and Israeli operations, including most probably in this last one. You know, I fully understand the relief that people feel when they see Noah, who was held captive, finally being embraced by her father, or being able to sit by her mother's side, who's terminally ill of cancer. I lost my mother to cancer, and I cherish every moment that I was able to spend with her, including the most painful ones. But I think people need to also think of the 270 Palestinians killed and the genocidal claim that there are no civilians in Gaza. Everyone is responsible. Everyone is guilty. It's unacceptable and inhumane. And if we had said anything close to that on the Israeli side, the whole world would be up in arms for such unacceptable statements. People also have to think of the thousands of cancer patients in Gaza who are not receiving treatment now for 8 months, who have lost their home, who have no hospital to go to, who have lost loved ones and don't have the time to mourn them, who have to move and be forcibly displaced from place to place, and they cannot answer the aches of their body because they are trying to survive every single day. 2.3 million Palestinians every single day are fighting to survive famine, bombings, killings. This situation, anybody who's able to justify such harm to civilians, such atrocities committed against civilians, have understood nothing about the lessons of history.
A new report by UN Independent Human Rights Body finds both Israel and Palestinian armed groups have committed war crimes since Hamas's surprise attack on October 7th. The damning UN report accuses Israel of using starvation as a method of warfare and intentionally directing attacks against civilians. The report also goes on to accuse Israel of committing numerous crimes against humanity, including, quote, extermination, murder, gender persecution targeting Palestinian men and boys, forcible transfer, and torture, unquote. The UN Commission also accused Hamas of also committing numerous war crimes, including intentionally directing attacks against civilians, as well as torture and, quote, indiscriminately firing projectiles towards populated areas in Israel, unquote. And the UN accuses both sides of committing sexual violence. If you can talk about how you see this ending right now, and also this move from country after country, for example, Spain and Sweden and other countries, recognizing Palestine as a state, does this lead in any way to the end of this conflict?
So we need to be consistent and coherent and be against harming civilians, regardless of their nationality, their religion, their ethnicity. That is the only way we preserve the rules of international law. And we are saddened that some are willing to sacrifice legality, humanity, morality to preserve Israeli impunity. That is not the way that these rules function. They cannot be discriminatory or they will stop existing. If you can justify it in one case, you'll be able to justify it in all cases. And what the way we see this ending is upholding international law, is ensuring accountability, ensuring there are consequences for these actions, and ending the reasons for the conflict, the root cause of the conflict between us and Israel, which is ending the occupation and allowing two states to live side by side. And that's what the Israeli leaders are saying exactly they don't want. They don't want a Palestinian state. They consider that our existence, that our rights are an existential threat for them. And that is an unacceptable position. And so sometimes you feel like the United States is the parent of an unruly child who is trying to tell him they should act differently, they should accept the two-state solution, they should end their occupation, and at the same time enabling them and shielding them from the consequences of their action. It's going to be very complicated. We saw that the U.S. proposal for a ceasefire received overwhelming support around the world, because that's what the world has been calling for. At the same time, we've seen that they're providing weapons to Israel has been also denounced across the world, because without them, Israel would not have been able to act the way it has been acting. Israel can insult its ally and say, we will stand alone if the U.S. is not happy, while taking the money of the U.S. and taking the weapons by the U.S. And that shouldn't be an acceptable position. And so countries are saying, if we believe in the two-state solution, we need to recognize the state of Palestine. Israel cannot have a veto over the right to existence of a nation. And they are saying, we need to take action against the colonization, and we need to take action against the atrocities that are committed, and we need to pursue accountability so this doesn't happen again. But for the time being, the priority is to stop the killing. 37,000 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza. 500 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank in the last 8 months. We have prisoners dying in detention in Guantanamo. In 20 years, you had 9 persons die in Israeli detention in the last 8 months than in 20 years in Guantanamo. That's how they're treating the Palestinians that they are holding captive. So if you want to be outraged, you need to be consistent in your outrage. You cannot be selective in your outrage, that this is unacceptable on this side, but as long as it's Israel doing it, somehow it becomes humane or justifiable.
Ambassador Majid Bamia, we thank you so much for being with us. Deputy Permanent Observer of the State of Palestine to the United Nations. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. To see all our coverage of Israel and Palestine, as well as so many issues, we urge you to go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
If you're a Canadian Indigenous student considering many life choices about your future, Inspire can help. If you need ideas about possible education or career path options specifically for First Nations, Métis, and Inuit folks like you, join Inspire's mentorship program, Rivers to Success. It's free to register, and you'll get plenty of up-to-the-minute information about university, college, and vocational trade schools. Most importantly, again, it's free. It's free, it's free, it's free. It's online, and we have monthly events with prizes. Discover the many potential job and study opportunities that are waiting for you across Turtle Island. Register online now at rivers2success.ca. Again, that's rivers2success.ca.